Coming up next on the Radio Zine, we hear an excerpt from Race Talks, a conversation series, filling the spaces between race with compassion and education. This program was recorded this past Tuesday, July 12th, at McMenamins Kennedy School. The program featured the Northwest contributors of What Does It Mean to Be White in America? Breaking the White Code of Silence, a collection of personal narratives. The following authors read condensed compilations of their essays from the book. Teresa Topferova-Botman, a Portland teacher and writer. Visual artist and writer Anne Mavor, or Maver. Founder and program director for People, Places, Things Intercultural Communications Services, Patrick McDade. Author and featured poet at the 2015 New York Poetry Festival, Leah Mueller. College writing adjunct professor Jan Priddy. Environmental and social justice writer and activist Janie Starr. And poetry and short fiction writer Carol Wilicki. Let's have a listen.
My name is Patrick McDade. I'm so grateful to everybody who came here. I sort of helped coordinate, bring this group together. And I'm the founder and program director for People, Places, Things. Some of the folks who work with me are in the room, and I really appreciate that, too. What we're supposed to address in our 30-second bio is sort of some way to connect to the humanness of why we're here. It sounds strange, but it's difficult to do that. I grew up in Tucson, Arizona, just about 45 minutes from the Mexican border, and yet growing up in Tucson, I didn't really connect much with Spanish speakers there. I connect more with them here. A fundamental question for me is just, what is my role? What am I supposed to do as a white person to actually move my privilege and make some kind of change in the world? This is one part of that, and I had no idea that the events of last week were going to happen at the time that they did, and that's part of the reason that a lot of you are here, so thanks for coming.
Hi, I'm Leah Mueller, and I live in Tacoma, Washington. I'm originally from Chicago, and I think this is amazingly timely. I was a little bit nervous. I still feel a little bit nervous, but I feel like, you know, we're doing an important thing and hopefully a helpful thing from being here. I've done lots of different writing for various publications. I won't name them. But I just want to say how thrilled I am to see such a large crowd here. And thank you so much. And also thanks to everybody else in this group and the publishers for putting together this important book.
My name is Buff Maid Meriton, and I'm actually standing in for Carol this evening. But like her, I'm a New York Jewess. And I moved out to Portland about 25 years ago. And I have to say that growing up in New York, I was around lots of different kinds of people. We shared each other's languages. We were, you know, elbow to elbow on the subway train, went to high school and junior high school and elementary school together. And I will say that probably I wasn't aware of it in New York, but when I came out to Portland, I got a real hit of what it meant to be white and privileged. So I'm still digesting what that means here. And what I have to say about it could be encapsulated in kind of one sentence, which I'm not supposed to say right now, but I'll say later, maybe in private. But I'm very glad that you're all here this evening and that we get to have this conversation.
Hi, I'm Janie Starr, and I live on Vashon Island near Seattle, so I'm the outlier in the group. I grew up in the Southeast, where I lived with the shameful belief that racism only existed below the Mason-Dixon line. I was adopted and I was completely clueless about the where did I come from, and so for years I used my ignorance to pretend that I wasn't white while benefiting from white privilege always. I'm old enough to have done a number of things. So I have been a sex educator and therapist, an environmental and climate activist, an anti-bias trainer. I've had a couple of life-threatening experiences, one of which led me to write a memoir, Bone Marrow Boogie, The Dance of a Lifetime, and all of them made me realize that I am damn lucky in addition to being privileged. I am passionate about race and gender equity, food justice, Zumba, and my 5-year-old grand girl.
Good evening. My name is Jan Priddy,
and I live on the coast now. I was born in Oregon, raised and spent most of my childhood in Seattle. When my husband and I moved back to Oregon, one of the shocks was how white Clatsop County is. It took a while. It was startling. It was noticeable. I've just retired last year after 40 years of teaching, mostly in the public schools. And for many years, most of my students were white. I gave them Toni Morrison. I gave them Sandra Cisneros. I gave them Chinua Achebe. I gave them stories that were unlike their lives, because that's what literature is for. I guess that's all I have to say.
I'm Teresa Bobman. I use my my maiden name also, Teresa Tepferova Bobman, for the publication. I came to the U.S. when I was a teenager from the Czech Republic. It was called Czechoslovakia back then. And I've been in Portland for 20 years, actually. This is my 20th anniversary this year. And I teach, I'm a teacher in public schools. I teach kids English, kids who are learning English in an elementary school, and this summer in high school. I also organize with Showing Up for Racial Justice. That's been my passion for many years, working in racial justice, but I feel like I helped found the Portland chapter, and I feel like that's been a really important part of my life, channeling, you know, just channeling my energy into action. I have two of my kids here, two of my three kids are back here, so if you hear some merry little voices, just bear with us. My three-year-old is here on my lap, and my 10-year-old is behind me, so I don't know what else.
Hello, my name is Anne Navor, and I'm a visual artist and writer, and the images hanging on the wall are from my large installation project that's going to be at Clackamas Community College in October. Hope you'll stop by. It's called I Am My White Ancestors Claiming the Legacy of Oppression. And I live just a few blocks away at a co-housing community called Columbia Eco Village. And my husband is here, Dennis Karras. He's my support reader, because I stutter, and it's easier for me to read out loud if I have a helper. So you may hear his voice in the background. And I'm happy to be here.
This is an American story, past the apple pie. Yet, I am not American, past the strudel.
This is your story and my story intertwined.
Skim milk and white and new snow, American's teeth, the inside of most apples, stratus clouds, locker room towels, fleet trucks, bathtubs, coconut flesh, porcelain, chalk, sugar, bleached flour, drawing paper, jockey shorts, daisy petals, loves me or loves me not. Picket fences, the whites of their eyes, the fog line beside the highway, and the sign that warns, do not pass.
For most of my life, I didn't even know I was white. What did I know about myself? Well, I knew I was born in Sacramento, California, to an Air Force dad and a mom who was a waitress. We were in Tucson because there was an Air Force base there, but by the time I was four, my mom and dad were divorced, and my mom remarried soon after, a carpenter. We were all white, and none of us knew it. Why didn't they tell us?
I grew up in Nashville, Tennessee, during segregation and lunch counter sit-ins. Too young to realize what was going on across town from my cozy childhood home. I woke up slowly to race awareness in my teens. I began to see the disparities around me and to speak out tentatively about social injustice. I cringed when my dad referred to a black man as a boy, and when my mom described our maid as childlike and uneducated. Yes, we had a maid. Her name was Laura.
All my dolls had pinkish skin, blue eyes, and blonde curly hair.
They did not resemble me in any detail. I dismantled them, pulled apart their arms and legs and removed their heads, studied their soft plastic joints, reassembled them in different order, used nail polish remover to wipe away their red lips and their dimpled pink cheeks, filled their bodies with dirt, left them out in the rain in the backyard. My childhood fury is what I conjure to remind myself what it means to stand before the master narrative and find myself excluded.
My mother, sister, and I came to this country in the late 1980s from Czechoslovakia, escaping totalitarianism. I was a teenager thrown for a loop. Everything about this culture confused me. Most of all, life felt lonely here. Initially, what I could not understand were the invisible lines which seemed to divide people.
I knew I was Polish, though. I knew that because it was weird. My mom told me my family had a lot of Polish in it, and I told someone else, and pretty soon that's what I was. I was a weird Polak who hung around with girls and used big words.
An aunt called me Little Sabra growing up because of my darker skin and curly black hair. It would be an absurd presumption, a kind of oppression chic, to not call myself white. And yet, just beneath my white skin, so much troubled history and fear. 30 years ago, back in Brooklyn, Mama warned me not to cross the Hudson. There be dragons, she might as well have said, and they are anti-Semites. I hopped a bus and traveled as far as I could, away from Jewish, away from grime, crime, and cramped living. I wasn't oblivious. In Jewish summer camp upstate, local kids threw stones and slurs at us at the county fair. I learned that kike meant me.
Among the photos in my hallway are matching oval portraits of my great-great-grandmother, Eugenia, and her husband, John. Eugenia was pretty and elegant with lace at her throat and wrists. John was black-haired with fierce eyes. The story passed down was that they were Confederate spies. That turned out not to be exactly true, but John did have to escape to Mexico with a price on his head during General Sherman's march at the end of the Civil War.
My great-grandmother on one side was from Mexico.
Summer in New Orleans lasts a very long time, especially when you're 19 and far from home. I lived alone in a sparsely furnished apartment located in the posh Garden District. From my bay window, I could see banana trees through the ornate metal porch grating while I lay on my $19 foam rubber mattress listening to music on my rented stereo. In 1978, the population of New Orleans was 75% African American, which for the first time in my life transformed me into a minority.
As I sat sewing Eugenia's enormous skirt and reading her letters, I was hit with a new understanding about my family legacy. The characteristics before me were all so familiar. Obedience, separation, ignorance, and quiet endurance.
One evening after work, I stretched out in my bed with a new copy of the Figaro newspaper. Its cover featured a color photograph of David Duke, recently appointed the Grand Dragon of the Ku Klux Klan. Duke was a classic Aryan man with pale skin, piercing blue eyes, and expertly feathered blonde hair. His face wore a deceptively ingenuous expression, as if he had no idea why so many people considered him to be so loathsome. The writer of the cover article was puzzled by Duke. He was the poster boy for racism, and yet He held an advanced degree, and his IQ was rumored to be off the charts. It was convenient for liberals to believe that all racists were mouth breathers, but David did not adhere to the stereotype. The writer described the bookstore that Duke ran in nearby Metairie, a dark, cavernous establishment known only to insiders. It contained an enormous cross bedecked with electric lights. Apparently, the cross was breathtaking in its immensity, especially when illuminated in an otherwise darkened room. I was both repulsed and intrigued. Perhaps if I spoke to him, he would say something that would resolve my own conundrum.
The White House. White knights, frosting, doves, feathers, pinprick stars, white chocolate, white out. In the West, white is the color of innocence and brides, and what we name white diamonds in her ring are colorless stones, clear like the raw white of a fresh egg. In light, white is all colors. In pigment, it is the absence of color. White opals are valued for the color sparkling their interior. A white paper is the concise and authoritative guide to solving a problem. Black Friday is the biggest shopping day of the year. The day retail goes solidly into the black and makes a profit. White imperialism, black power, black heart, white swan.
How we are named and what we are called.
In 1967, I attended Vanderbilt University, the same year that Perry Wallace did. His entry was momentous because he was breaking the color barrier in the basketball Southeastern Conference. When my father complained about black players being the ruination of his college basketball team, I knew I was done whispering. My attempts to argue with him were futile, however. He was a formidable opponent. In his presence, I stumbled and mumbled my words. He would not bend. I was afraid of breaking. I married and moved away to the Pacific Northwest.
After 6 months of full-time research on my project, I ended up with a combination of likely ancestors covering 2,000 years of European American history from 1870 back to 300 BCE. In America, the list includes
two slaveholders from South Carolina,
a pilgrim from Plymouth Colony who gained land and resources from the Wampanoag.
Traveling back in time to Britain, I chose
a Scottish farmer who was a juror on a witch trial,
an English mercenary soldier, and a social climber who fought to colonize Ireland.
An English noblewoman caught in the middle of the bloody War of the Roses.
In the medieval era, there was
a Basil cheesemaker who supported the execution of Jews during the Black Death.
King Edward I of England, who conquered Wales, invaded Scotland, and expelled the Jews from England.
A Frankish countess who became a nun and benefited from the colonization of Jerusalem during the Crusades.
Lastly, I found
a Norman knight who helped Duke William conquer England,
a female Viking who invaded Orkney,
and a gold metal worker from the Celtic Iron Age who supported the warrior elite.
I am not exceptional. Similar ancestor stories are replicated throughout history.
My particular family came to America from England, Scotland, and Switzerland during the early development of the country with all the benefits contained therein. land, slave and indentured labor, and natural resources, there is no question that I have profited from being European American from the day I was born.
Could I use my history to model what taking responsibility might look like?
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 13th annual PDX Pop Now Festival, a three-day all-ages music festival, Friday, July 22nd through Sunday, July 24th at Audio Cinema in Portland. 43 artists will be performing over the 3 days, including special high school band sets curated by Friends of Noise. The festival also features a record fair, street fair, food carts, and more. Again, that's the 13th annual PDX Pop Now Festival, a three-day, all-ages music festival, Friday, July 22nd through Sunday, July 24th at Audio Cinema, 226 Southeast Madison Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And we've been listening to an excerpt from Race Talks, a conversation series filling the spaces between race with compassion and education. This program was recorded this past Tuesday, July 12th, at McMenamin's Kennedy School by Janka Soderberg and Chris Andre. The program featured the Northwest contributors of What Does It Mean to Be White in America? Breaking the White Code of Silence, a collection of personal narratives and subtitles.
I flipped open the phone book. If there was another man in the New Orleans metro area who bore the unfortunate name of David Duke, I could simply apologize to him and terminate the call. I reached over to the phone and lifted the receiver. May I please speak to David Duke? I'd like to talk to David about the Klan. I'm curious about your bookstore, and I'd like to see it.
The process of discovering my whiteness and how deep it goes and how unconscious it is has been long and meandering. It's about the assumption that white is normal. It's about the deck being stacked. Something I've learned about my whiteness is that it's slippery.
Reading about the sociology of class and white Anglo-Saxon Protestant WASP culture provided me with a key to unlock some of the mysteries that have colored my experience in this society, but which I couldn't understand because my family comes from a Slavic stock shaped by a mix of Jewish and Catholic influences. Gradually, I came to find that I could credit much of my reality in this society to white supremacy culture.
It was 1980, and I landed in Oregon. In random conversations with bus drivers, store owners, in a book group, at a party, someone would pull out the phrase, "You New York types," or ask with a disarming smile, "What is your ethnicity?" You could hear the question coming long before it was spoken, a chess move you knew in your bones. The ego wished to catalog, to know, ah, a Jew. I was no longer with my people, and I felt it.
Sun-bleached shells, dress shirts, bleached cotton, froth on the leading edge of every wave, white supremacists, white lies, fresh bandages.
The bus ride was hot and interminable. As my stop neared, I grew anxious. I pulled the cord and disembarked from the bus. I stood for a moment on the sidewalk in front of Duke's bookstore, blinking like a mole in the harsh mid-afternoon light. I rang the doorbell, and then I stood on the threshold, fidgeting. "Welcome to my store," he said expansively. "Are you thirsty? I can offer you a Pepsi." He fixed me with a beatific grin and watched approvingly as I took an appreciative gulp from the bottle.
On white nights, the sun never goes down. In a whiteout, your life is at risk from cold and confusion.
Oppressive beliefs and behaviors like racism, colonization, and genocide had their source in Europe. We must have learned them somewhere, or at least become vulnerable to accepting them as truth. Patterns like greed, arrogance, superiority, and believing that conquering other people and their land and resources is the right thing to do in the name of honor, religion, family, and country. I was not proven wrong. All those things are illustrated in European history over and over.
I came from these specific people. My body is connected to them. The color of my skin, the shape of my nose and eyes, texture of my hair, my height, my hands.
I put on types of clothes they might have worn and imagine my hands fingering a sword, wielding an axe, carrying a bowl of soup, skinning a rabbit, sewing a dress, preparing for the next battle, believing that I am right.
All of the walls were lined with pamphlets that bore such ominous titles as The Negro Problem and Taking Back Our Heritage. A glass shelf stood beside the cash register, filled to overflowing with souvenir coffee cups and glow-in-the-dark Klansmen figurines. "What do you think of our inventory?" Duke asked. "Pretty impressive, huh?" "Well, there certainly is a lot of it," I said politely. "But really, what is the point of this bookstore? What are you trying to do here exactly?" "Well, I started this bookstore with a mission," he explained. "I don't hate black people. They have their own heritage, and I respect that. You and I are white, however, and we have a different heritage. I'm proud of our heritage, and I want to preserve it." He stared into my eyes like a trained hypnotist while his long hands gestured in front of my face. I returned his gaze, nodded slowly, and I found myself sinking into a kind of spell. Then I shook my head as if I had just returned to land after spending some time underwater, and I opened my mouth to speak. "I'm not interested in joining the Klan," I said. "I was just curious to find out how you operate over here."
"The ideology of whiteness as status utterly envelops us Europeans in its poisonous embrace. We cannot escape its cocoon. Rather, we carry whiteness with us like a charm that protects us from harm, shields us from impact as we dive from the known to the unknown, parachute from one spot on the globe to another as immigrants, tourists, or do-gooders abroad. The poison of white supremacy we ingest with our mother's milk lingers."
"Hospital sheets are not all white anymore. White is bleached. White is dead. White is blinding bright.
People get confused about racism."
"How could racism possibly have created such rifts between people?"
"In the early 1990s, I joined forces with an African-American teacher at my son's school in Tacoma, Washington. Together, Stan and I began to preach and teach and lead trainings with whomever would listen on the subject of racism, sexism, and white privilege. We were relentless, and then we weren't. I moved again. We lost touch. I thought about Stan often, though, along with the stories he told of integrating an all-white school in Louisiana. joining the military because it was the safest place to be a black man married to a white woman, raising mixed-race sons, driving while black, shopping while black, being black.
Just try calling white people white. One of the things that'll happen is that a lot of white people will call you racist. What's really going on is they want you to protect them from never having to think about race. That's protecting their privilege. The privilege to walk through life whistling and not having to think about it.
The Brooklyn neighborhood my sister and I grew up in was largely black and Jewish. The first boy I kissed was black, as was the girl who taught me to peck out a boogie-woogie on the black keys of her family piano. I felt comfortable in that mixed world, the world I'd known up until then.
Race should not stand between people, should not make us suspicious of motive and genuine affection. But it does. Race matters. Sometimes the white fog between people bars friendship.
As the neighborhood became more black, whites who could afford it moved to the suburbs. The familiar pattern. In memory, it was the end of, if not color blindness, then a kind of color unselfconsciousness. We moved to a whiter neighborhood of Italians, Irish, Greeks, Jews, people like ourselves.
I have a white friend who asked me one time, "How often do you think about your race?" I told her, maybe 3 or 4 times a week. I thought I was being honest with myself, admitting that I sometimes think about race. And she said, "See that black guy over there? How often do you think he thinks about race?" And then it happened. I turned white.
Duke's enormous cross hung majestically on one wall and looked down upon folding chairs and cardboard boxes of Klan literature. Its bulbs gleamed ominously in the semi-darkness. He reached inside one of the boxes and removed a handful of slightly yellowed newspapers. "Please take these and read them if you get the chance." Because I had been trained to be polite, I allowed Duke to place the newspapers into my hand. My fingers reflexively clutched the pages before I could even think of an excuse.
"I do not decline to acknowledge my race on the forms." I check the box.
"Non-Hispanic, surname Caucasian."
"I am fortunate. I am privileged. I am white. I cannot deny this."
I don't want to put my ex on white because I feel somewhat alienated from the party, unsure exactly who is friend or foe. Jews are well accepted in America, and I do not want to overstate the case. My whiteness protects me and privileges me and hides me as well.
I have continued to work for economic, racial, and social justice, to take up the torch on behalf of the environment and climate, women and girls, domestic violence survivors, and people of all colors suffering from hunger and food insecurity. I have attempted to advocate for the Latinos, the major minority where I live, but I had allowed myself to forget the role of privilege in the perpetuation of these wrongs.
I truly am my white ancestors.
My life is filled with decisions I make to maintain a privileged life based on the oppression of others, past and present. I keep silent when I hear comments among my white friends that are subtly racist. I live off money I inherited from my grandparents and parents. I don't have many friends who are not white. I let fear stop me from reaching out to people of color. I buy clothes made by people who are paid poorly and work in unsafe conditions. I live in a nice apartment and eat healthy food and look away from people who are homeless and poor. Mostly these are ways I stay passive and unconscious because to feel the full truth about racism and the harmful effects of capitalism would be unbearable.
Being white is a passport whose benefits I enjoy. It gives access. But I was born with dual citizenship, and that dualism sometimes chafes. Just beneath white, I want to write Jew, because to assert Jew is to raise a defiant middle finger to history. The history of my dear people's destruction and permanent unease within the dark side of European Christianity, the progenitors of who we talk about when we talk about white in America.
At first glance, whiteness as status is all benefits, advantages, a shiny package of sparkly goodies. But the truth is that white people don't make it through unscathed. Clearly, maintaining this hegemonic system comes at a cost to us whites. Recent studies show that white, middle-aged men, unlike other groups, have a mortality rate that is rising at a rapid pace. They are dying from stress-related causes. White Americans are also the biggest terror threat. We have been led to feel disconnected from the humanity of others as well as from our own. We fear being cast out from the only club to which we tentatively belong.
This is the deadly setup we are up against, and it is high time for us to attempt to break free from these narratives
and redefine our place as white people in the society and the world.
The steady hum of white noise puts us to sleep.
I did not sleep through the news in recent years as stories of police brutality escalated. I grumbled at the so-called liberal voices on NPR, yelled at the voices of vitriol and hatred on Fox News, bemoaned voices of cocooned white people like myself. I whined with those friends who agreed with me, and I did not act. I did not organize. I did not speak out in public. I did not read the articles I chose to like on Facebook. I did not comment. It was just too much. Then one day, a young white man walked into the Emmanuel AME Church in Charleston, South Carolina, where the predominantly African-American congregation welcomed him with open arms. After berating them, he opened fire and gunned down 9 people, including the senior pastor, and I woke up for good.
I scurried away from Duke's bookstore. Finally, I boarded the bus. As I fumbled in my purse for change, I accidentally dropped the clump of newspapers. An updraft caught one of the newspapers, and the pages tumbled through the aisle like autumn leaves. I stumbled down the center of the bus and hastily gathered the papers while the passengers stared straight ahead, indifferent to my plight. One of the pages came to rest beside a middle-aged African-American woman's foot. She lifted the paper from the floor and handed it to me. Finally, she redirected her gaze towards the dirt-encrusted bus window and stared outside with an impassive expression on her face. "Thanks," I said, as I slid into the space beside her.
Colors show on white. The pale page reveals the text like the stripes make the zebra. It is the words that register, not the page.
I want to believe that given a chance, human connection always wins out.
I do not decline to answer. I am answerable. I have no answers. I listen.
Most white people are no longer white supremacists, but still believe they are superior. In order not to be white superior, you have to recognize there's an assumption that whiteness is normal, and you have to commit to ending it, not just pretend it isn't there.
Every week, if not day, come new stories of police violence against black men and women, unarmed, armed, guilty, innocent. The crisis of black demolition remains a constant. It's a crisis of forest, not just trees.
I am obligated to witness this.
What matters is that I no longer remain silent. What matters is that I make my own noise, that I add my voice to the crescendo of all people demanding justice, to work together to seek solutions for all people.
I am scared that the violence lurking beneath the mask of white supremacy will bubble out, targeting me as a woman, as someone with Jewish heritage, someone with a black partner and mixed race kids. This fear is real and visceral, but I organize despite it. 2 years ago or 3 years ago, I helped form a group to educate, organize, and mobilize white people to work for racial justice. We raise funds for grassroots organizations led by people of color. We volunteer our time and skills. We bring food. We show up to and plan rallies. We phone bank and door knock to discuss issues pertinent to our community and to the Black Lives Matter movement. We educate ourselves as well as other white people in our circles. We practice interrupting racism. This is heart work for me. This is my antidote to violence, apathy, and despair.
Embracing white identity and heritage as a step toward ending racism might seem counterintuitive, but this history is living in all white people in varying ways, and the more we deny it, the bigger it looms. For me, this process has been a way to understand and feel a part of my historical family, while at the same time taking responsibility for their actions and the privileges I inherited.
I am heartened by the fact that more and more white people are moving away from their screens, NPR stations, and the New York Times editorials, and are taking up their own placards and homemade signs, hitting their own streets and street corners, witnessing and speaking out. I am heartened by the response I have received to my own rants on the subject. We are not all demonstrators and agitators, stump speakers and sign wavers. Some of us are too old to hit the streets, some of us too young. I'm not intimating that all white people lead charmed lives.
You said it.
While our white skin gives us an advantage, it does not guarantee our success. Some of us are struggling to just get by, holding down two jobs, raising our kids alone, out of work, underpaid, and without much hope of our own betterment. In the main, however, we do not fear for our lives, our families, our homes, our jobs, and future, for no other reason than our skin color. We get a pass. So I am suggesting, no, urging, goading, and inciting my fellow white ones to move beyond guilt, self-justification, fear, or blame, and to take up the banner in whatever way makes meaning and is possible for you. Housing segregation, the school-to-prison pipeline, police brutality and racial profiling all demand our attention.
Yes. We need to do it.
So choose your heart cause, your area of expertise. Seek new knowledge, apply a new skill. Tweet, chat, stand in silence. Speak at your place of worship and work. Involve your friends and coworkers in conversation. Share information. And by all means, tell your own story as well. Keep on keeping on, no matter what. And please include your kids. Find out what they think, what they see, and participate in at school. Let them help you if they ask. Mostly, let them be reassured by your action.
Times change, but not fast enough. We are a nation of many skin colors.
We are all shades of human.
Being pro-black or pro-brown does not require us to be anti-white. It requires us to act. As members of the dominant culture,
whether or not we feel dominant, we have the opportunity as well as the responsibility to change that culture from the inside out.
It's on us.
I try to embody what I long for other white people to do, which is to answer the call to acknowledge and renounce whiteness for its historical and current inseparability from racial violence and oppression. I want white people to organize en masse, divest ourselves from the narrow definition of success in the capitalistic society that forces us to subscribe to the deadly values of white supremacy. What is asked of us is nothing short of building a new world rooted in collective action, shaped by a narrative that strives to re-envision, co-create, collaborate, liberate across ingrained divisions of race, class, gender, and all the rest.
From my privileged perch, I understand that I get to choose. For me, being a restrained ally is no longer enough. Think of the splash we'll make if we all dive in together. So what is this white girl to do? Show up, take a leap, swim like my heart and soul depend on it, because in fact, they do.
Pass the trowel, take the hoe, and let's keep working together.
And finally, this morning, we hear an excerpt from the news series, Between the Lines. Following, we had been listening to an excerpt from Race Talks, a conversation series filling the spaces between race with compassion and education, recorded July 12th at McMenamin's Kennedy School by KBOO's own Jenka Soderberg and Chris Andre. We're going to close out the radio zine with an excerpt from Between the Lines for the current week, July 15th through the 21st of 2016.
After 2 years of focus on police violence, protests, and debate, America just witnessed a tumultuous week, which began with the police shooting deaths of Philando Castile in Falcon Heights, Minnesota, and Alton Sterling in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Both incidents, documented in part on smartphone video recordings, went viral across American social media and around the globe. The police shootings of these two African-American men were followed by the murder of five police officers and the wounding of seven others in Dallas, Texas, during a peaceful Black Lives Matter protest march. The sniper attack was carried out by a lone U.S. Army veteran who told police negotiators before his death that he was angry about recent police violence. Following the police shootings, Black Lives Matter protests were held in dozens of cities across the U.S., with the participation of tens of thousands. In some cities, civil disobedience actions resulted in hundreds of arrests. Your reporter spoke with Graylin Hagler, senior pastor at Washington, D.C.'s Plymouth Congregational United Church of Christ. Here, Reverend Hagler examines why Americans remain so divided on the issues of police accountability and race after a week of tragic violence.
We have to thank Black Lives Matter for remaining in the streets and remaining in people's faces and continuing to press the issue and to lift up the issue and to carry on strategies and confrontations that continue to remind the overall society that things are not well, and that there are things that have to be addressed. Because one thing that most Black people and people of color understand in this country does not talk about race unless it's forced to talk about race. That is America's best-kept secret, but at the same time, America's greatest sin, is that they do not talk about their greatest sin, and they try to make it something else, and they try to deny that there is any racism involved, and they want to call it something else. And that's part of the problem, is that America has never confronted its problems with race and its issues around racism.
Reverend Hagler, following the most recent police shooting deaths of the black men in Minnesota and Louisiana, the debate in this country often devolves into a divisive and polarized argument where many people believe they have to choose sides to either support the Black Lives Matter protesters or support the police. But of course, there is another option. People can support the police and support changes in our system of policing that will reduce this kind of police violence and the feeling of many people in poor communities that the police are an occupying army.
People don't have any problem supporting the police as long as the police are engaged in righteous actions. In the eyes of the Fraternal Order of Police, police never do anything wrong, and that's part of the problem, everybody in the police departments are not correct. Everybody in the police department is not biased, right? I mean, you know, the fact is that there's always a diversity, and clearly people have to call it for what it is. And unfortunately, part of the polarizing discussion and the debate becomes those who are protecting law enforcement, those who are representing law enforcement, are basically arguing to the extreme and pretending as if there's nothing wrong in the police department. Also, we've witnessed over the last number of years the radical militarization of civilian police departments. And what I mean, domestic police departments, for example, what happened in Dallas should be really of concern to folks, that you put a bomb on a robot that went in and blew somebody up. That should be really real concern. Where did the bomb come from? Is the bomb stored in a warehouse somewhere? What else is stored in a warehouse somewhere? We should all be asking these questions, because this is part of the problem why police are seen as an occupying army, because of the severe militarization that goes on. And the fact is that if you got it, you're going to use it. And unfortunately, it's been used too much.
Well, just a final question for you, Reverend Hagler, and that is, as you look at the national Black Lives Matter movement dispersed across hundreds of cities all across this country, what would be your priority in terms of organizing for action and a list of demands in terms of the situation in our country today?
Well, I think that you got the list of demands obviously should be to really construct a whole model of community policing. Two, that the police departments be under the scrutiny of the federal government, of an agency in the federal government, where they will have to report gun discharges, have to report the arrest rates and who is being arrested and who is being detained, who is being stopped, who is being shot down, so that we have an indication of who is doing what out there. The other thing that is clear is that folks need to be submitted to all kinds of psychological testing to be able to realize who is actually equipped to be of service and who should not. And also, the other issue is that we should not be supplying police departments out of surplus equipment that has come off the battlefields of Iraq and the battlefields of Afghanistan, and the grants to buy those kinds of weaponry that really begins to set you up as an assault unit rather than as a policing unit. And yes, of course, people should be come out of the local communities and should have the opportunities to come out of the local communities and serve.
That was Reverend Graylin Hagler, senior pastor of the Plymouth Congregational United Church of Christ in Washington, D.C. For more perspectives on the issues of police violence and racial division, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, also known by its acronym REGI, includes all the New England states plus New York, Maryland, and Delaware in a cap-and-trade program to reduce carbon emissions region-wide and raise money from the sale of pollution permits to fund green energy projects. The concept is that the cap on allowable emissions progressively decreases, thus reducing pollution. But critics say the problem with this and similar cap-and-trade programs is those very pollution permits, which allow companies to continue pouring both climate and ground-level pollution into the air, are mostly located in communities that are already heavily burdened by such pollution and are often low-income communities of color. Now an organization wants to use the program review process of REGI to push for including protections for these communities and to prioritize the funds raised to clean up the worst pollution, giving these communities a say in how the funds are spent. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Caitlin Parody, communications director with the group Toxics Action Center, who explains how a coalition of groups is working to make sure these climate justice initiatives are incorporated into the REGI process going forward.
This issue of fossil fuel pollution and climate change has really become a very important part of our work because of the experiences that frontline communities are having. And right now, REGI is actually going through a program review. And so we have been involved in forming a loose coalition to really take advantage of this moment and campaign to make sure that as the program evolves, we see really tough limits on pollution and that we see low-income communities, communities of color, and communities where fossil fuel infrastructure or environmental injustice have been concentrated, that they really have a say in what REGI looks like and how it's implemented and that they benefit from the program. And I think part of, you know, what that speaks to is this question of, okay, so you're driving down overall carbon pollution through REGI, that's great, but do we have local hotspots where maybe actually you have a lot of companies that are buying these permits instead of cleaning up their act in particular communities? And so one of the things that we really want to make sure is that that concern is really honored and heard, and that as we go through this program review, an environmental justice analysis that includes, you know, analyzing proximity and cumulative impacts is part of the program review, so that we can really make sure that, in fact, marginalized communities are benefiting from the program and not seeing any increase in localized emissions.
Caitlin Parody, I live in Connecticut, and we still have one coal-burning power plant left in Bridgeport, which the company is planning to replace in a few years with a gas-burning plant.
We have a long history of working in Bridgeport to help shut down Bridgeport Harbor Station. One of the asks that this loose coalition of groups is making is really that we set a stringent cap, overall cap on pollution. The specific ask is to set a cap that goes down 5% from 2020 levels every year through 2030. And one of the things that a strong cap like that can do is really help make sure that coal-fired power plants can't stay open, or in particular that they won't be refired with gas. And so it helps send this market signal that fossil fuel, you know, isn't the way to go, and also does kind of deal with this transition question where we don't see some of these coal-fired power plants that are going offline all over New England refired with gas. And then the other piece of this that I think is just so critical and really like where a lot of our involvement stems from is that we really want to make sure that the REGI process is accessible to frontline communities and communities that, like the community near the Bridgeport plant, that have just faced so much environmental injustice and lived with these smokestacks for years, so that they have a say both in how it's implemented and how its proceeds are distributed, and so that they're given assurance that a plant like Bridgeport isn't going to be more likely to stay open, isn't going to be able to buy all these permits or be refired with gas, you know, whatever it might be, that they have some assurances that they're going to have less pollution in their community because of REGI. And then we also ask that the money made through REGI, it should be heavily invested in communities that have dealt with the harmful health effects of fossil fuel power generation, again, like Bridgeport, and in programs that are really going to deliver benefits there.
That was Caitlin Parody, communications director with the Toxics Action Center. Learn more about the effort to incorporate climate justice mandates into the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.com.
And we thank Between the Lines for sharing that with us here at your community radio, KBOO Portland. The time is 11:59 a.m. Coming up at noon, it's Moving On with your host, the one and only, the fantastic and what a gal, Lori Sonnenfeld. Right after this.
K-
KABU is a proud sponsor of One Flaming Arrow Intertribal Film Festival 2016, bringing Native American and Indigenous independent film to Portland, Oregon, July 28th through the 31st. Opening night at Clinton Street Theater with showings through the weekend at Hollywood Theater and Rainmaker Gallery. Please consider